Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 4, Discourse Number 6.
The first question. Bhagwan, it seems to me that being here with you means to let go of everything, not only the misery, fear, sadness and the so-called negative spaces, but also the happy, loving, flowing feelings, the so-called positive spaces that have always been my goal. Bhagwan, is this the way it is? Anand Harish, the positive and the negative, the night and the day, the summer and winter, the birth and death, they are not separate. If you want to let go of one, you will have to allow the other also to go. That is one of the greatest dilemmas. People want the positive to remain with them. But if the positive remains, the negative remains as its shadow. The positive will not have any meaning without the negative. If you don't know what darkness is, you will not be able to see light at all. If you want to see light, you will have to be ready to experience darkness too. You cannot avoid death if you cling to life. It is life that brings death in. And everybody wants to cling to the positive spaces. And everybody wants to avoid the negative spaces. This is impossible. This is against the eternal law. If you watch carefully, you will see that if the negative is torturing too much, then the positive is only a cover-up. What do you mean when you call that you are happy? You simply mean that at this moment my unhappiness is covered up. What do you mean when you say that now I am relaxed? It simply means that the tensions have gone deeper into the unconscious. Now you are oblivious of them. But sooner or later they will assert. Sooner or later they will have their own time. You cannot remain with the positive forever. The negative and positive always balance each other. You will have as much happiness as you are ready to have unhappiness. Hence, one of the mysteries, more affluent a society is, the more miserable it is. Now there is no other country more miserable than America, for the simple reason that America has now the highest peak of happiness. It cannot avoid the lowest depth. The peaks are possible only with valleys. Higher the peak, deeper the valley. In India, people feel very satisfied. The reason is they don't know the peaks of happiness. Hence, they don't know the valleys of unhappiness. They live more or less on neutral ground, neither positive nor negative. This is not true contentment. This is simply absence of positive spaces. Hence, the negative spaces are also absent. America is really in a mental torture, in a great psychological upheaval. No society has ever been in such a state. Individuals, of course, have been. Gautam Buddha was the son of a king. He had all the joys. That's why he became aware of the misery of life. It is not accidental. All the 24 Tirthankaras of the Jainas are kings. Buddha is a king. Rama and Krishna are kings. All the Hindu avataras are kings. There is something in it, something very fundamental. Why beggars have not become Tirthankaras, avataras, Buddhas? For the simple reason, they don't know what happiness is. How can they be aware of the misery of life? Buddha says life is dukkha, pure misery. Only a Buddha can say it, because he has known the peaks. Knowing the peaks is simultaneously becoming aware of the valleys. If you live intensely, passionately, you will be more aware of death than the person who lives in a lukewarm way, who lives only so-so, who is not intense and passionate in his life. He cannot be very alert about death. Deeper your plunge into life, more will be your awareness of death. The positive and the negative continuously balance each other. The Indians have played a trick upon themselves. They have become neutral. Don't go to the heights of joy. That is the way to avoid the depths of misery, pain, sorrow. But this is not true revolution. True revolution is not by becoming indifferent, by becoming lukewarm, by living a very, very dull life. Real revolution happens through transcendence. These two words have to be understood, because the difference is very delicate and subtle. Indifference and transcendence. Indifference simply means you avoid the positive to avoid the negative. Transcendence means you avoid nothing, neither the positive nor the negative. You live the positive in its totality and you live the negative in its totality, with a new quality, and that quality is that of a witness. You live totally, but at the same time you remain silently alert, aware. You know happiness surrounds you, but you are not it. You know unhappiness surrounds it, but you are not it. You know it is day, but you are not it. And you know it is night, but you are not it. You know now you are alive, but you are not it. Then when you will be dying, you will know you are not it. This is transcendence. Neti neti, neither this nor that, is the secret formula of transcendence. Neither positive nor negative. But it does not mean not to live the positive and the negative. If you avoid living, you will become dull, very dull. You will lose all intelligence. That's the difference in the old sannyas and my new vision of sannyas. The old sannyas teaches you indifference, neutrality. Don't go to the heights, so you need not fall into the depths. Simple mathematics. Don't be happy, then you will not be unhappy. How you can be unhappy if you have never been happy? Don't rejoice, then there will be no sorrow. And don't laugh, then tears will not be possible. This is simple mathematics, but not the truth of transcendence, not the truth of real sannyas. The real sannyas means laugh deeply, but remember you are not the laughter, and cry and weep deeply, let the tears flow, be total in it, and yet alert, a flame inside, watching it all. Haris, you are to transcend, not to renounce. If you renounce, you miss the point. And when I say let go, I simply mean don't cling. I am not saying to you, don't try to be happy. Make every possible effort to be happy, joyous. But remember that sadness will follow. That is natural. Accept it. And when it comes, don't run away from it. Don't escape from it. That too is beautiful. Part of life, part of growth. Without it, there is no maturity. Go deep into it. Joy has something to contribute to your growth, and sorrow too. Joy brings a freshness, the freshness of the morning dew. Joy brings youth. Joy brings a dance to your heart. Sadness also brings many gifts. But you escape from sadness, hence you never become aware of the gifts. Sadness brings a silence which no joy can ever bring. Joy is always a little noisy. Sadness is utterly silent. Joy is always a little shallow. Sadness is deep. It has depth. Joy always makes you forget yourself. It is easier to drown yourself in joy, to be intoxicated with joy. It keeps you unconscious. Sadness brings an awareness, because you cannot drown yourself in it. You cannot participate. You have to stand out, because you don't want it. The first lessons of witnessing happen in sadness. One learns witnessing in sadness, and only then later on the same witnessing can be applied to the moments of pleasure. But it is by witnessing that one transcends. And when I say let go of it all, the positive and the negative, I simply mean don't cling. Don't be identified. I am not saying renounce. Live, and yet live above. Walk on the earth, but no, don't let your feet touch the earth. Yes, there is an art to it. And that's what sannyas is all about. The art of living in the world without being part of it. The art of living life without being identified with it. That's what real let go is. The old sannyas is that of indifference. Exactly that is the word used in the old scriptures. A sannyasin becomes udasin, indifferent to all that is. Vairagya. He becomes cold and detached. He escapes from the world of duality. He moves into a monastery or in the Himalayan caves, lives alone, lives without joy, without sadness. A kind of death he lives. He is already in his grave. He lives not. His life is not worth calling life. He has fallen below humanity. He is closer to the animals than to human beings. Hence his search for the caves, forests, jungles, mountains, deserts. He is afraid of being with human beings. He wants to fall below human beings, because human beings are bound to be divided by this great polarity, positive and negative, and he is afraid of it. But the real sannyasin, the sannyasin of my vision, lives in the world, in the thick, in the dense world. He renounces nothing. He lives the life as totally as possible. Because if God has given the life, it means there is something to attain through it. By living it, only it can be attained. By living it, only something is there which has to be learned. Transcendence has to be learned. That is the great gift of life. If you become more and more conscious, let go will happen. and yet you will be here and now and more than ever before. You will eat and you will taste more. You will love and you will have deeper orgasmic experiences. You will play and your play will have something of the spiritual in it. Your ordinary life will become sacred. Only one thing has to be introduced: witnessing. The second question: Bhagwan, I am feeling more and more that this life is something magical. Is this how you see life? Is this what you mean by the godliness all about us? Yes, Anandanur, precisely that's what I mean. By God, I don't mean a person. By God, I mean the magic that surrounds you, the mysterious, the miraculous. By God, I don't mean anybody who created the world, but creation itself. The very process of creativity is God. Hence you cannot worship God. You cannot pray to God. All prayers are false because they are addressed to a personal God and there is no personal God. You cannot relate to God, calling him father, mother. He is not a person. Relationship is not possible. Then how to worship? How to pray? You will have to learn new ways of praying and worshipping. To be creative is to worship. To be creative is to participate in the great process of creation. And participating in creativity is participating in God. For a moment you are transported. When you are painting something, you are no more there. You have become just a creative force. When you are playing music, if you are not just a technician, but really a musician, a lover of music, then you disappear. Then the ego is no more there. At least for those few rare diamond-like moments. Immensely precious, some windows open. You are no more there. Not as an ego. God is not a person. He is not an ego. And if you want to meet God, you will have to be something similar. A non-ego. A non-person. God is a presence. If you want to have any communion with God, you will have to learn how to be just a presence and not a person. alert, fully alert, but without any idea of I. And the best way to let this I disappear is not through austerities, yoga, fasting. No. It is through creativity. I teach you the yoga of creativity. Because to me that is the only yoga. The word yoga means union. When you are creative, you are in a state of union with God. Standing on your head is not going to help much. In fact, it is not going to help at all. You can stand on your head for lives. It will do only one thing. It will make you stupid. And I am saying a scientific truth. I am not joking. I am very serious about it. If you stand on your head for long times, you will become stupid. Because your brain consists of very, very delicate nervous system. Those nerves are so thin, they are thinner than the hairs. Your small head has millions of nerves. You cannot see them by your naked eyes, they are so thin. If you stand on your head too long, the blood rushes towards your head, and in that flood, those nerves are going to be destroyed. In fact, scientists say, man attained to mind, brain, because he stood on two legs, upright. Animals have not attained to brain yet, because they go on still, remaining parallel to the earth. Their head is getting too much blood. Hence they cannot grow subtle nervous system. It is only man who has been able to grow a subtle nervous system which can sustain great consciousness, which can sustain great intelligence. It is very rare to come across an intelligent so-called yogi. I have not come across yet. The people who distort their bodies and do all kinds of circus and stand on their heads, they may have good bodies. They can have. So much gymnastic is bound to give you a healthier body, more animal-like. But they don't have intelligence. I have yet to come across a yogi who is really intelligent. And one of the reasons is their subtle, delicate nervous system is too much flooded with blood. You cannot sleep in the night without the pillow. Do you know why? Because too much blood goes in the head. It keeps your whole nervous system vibrating. You need pillows. Pillows keep the blood flow less towards the head. You can sleep. You can rest. You can relax. By yoga, I exactly mean the literal translation, union, communion. When you are painting or playing music or dancing or singing, then you are in a state of yoga. In my commune, this is going to be the yoga. You have to create. And the more you create, the more you become capable of creating. The more you create, the sharpened is your intelligence. The more you create, the more you become available to infinite sources of creativity. That is God. The more you create, the more you become a vehicle. A vehicle for the magic to flow through you. Yes, Anand Noor, by God I mean the magic that surrounds you. Can't you feel the magic that surrounds you every moment? This very moment. The birds making sounds, the trees utterly silent in a state of meditation, and you all here together with me from far away countries. A silence pervading. You are utterly tuned with me, breathing with me, your hearts beating with my heart. Can't you see the magic of the now, of the here, and the beauty of it, and the benediction? This is God. God is not found in the temples and the mosques and the gurudwaras and the churches. God is found only in the company of the Buddhas. Because it is only in the company of the Buddhas that you become aware of the magical existence. The third question, Bhagwan, why are people so much against you? Sudhir, they are not so much against me as they are afraid of me. Out of fear, they are against, but root cause is fear. And why they are afraid? Because they don't understand. It is misunderstanding. It always happens, it is bound to happen. It is nothing new. I say one thing, they understand something else. Because their minds are prejudiced. They have been brought up in certain traditions, and I am breaking all traditions. They have been brought up to think in certain ways, and my whole effort here is to take you beyond thinking. People are conventional, conformist, traditional, and to me religion is rebellion. Rebellion against all conventions, against all conformities, against all traditions. Religion is never a tradition, can never be a tradition. Science can be a tradition, but religion never. Science is really a tradition. Vidra Newton. For a moment think Newton never was born. Then there can be no Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein is possible only if Newton happens first. Science is a tradition. It is a continuum. Withdraw one brick and the whole edifice falls. But I am possible without there ever being a Christ. I am possible not because there has been a Mahavira or a Patanjali. Not because there has been a Buddha or a Confucius or Lao Tzu. Religion is not a continuum. It is an individual phenomenon. It is an individual flowering. You can become awakened even if you are not aware of anybody ever becoming awakened before. You are not related with the past in the same way as science is related. And that's why scientific truths, once discovered, become the property of everybody else. Albert Einstein worked hard for 13 years to discover the theory of relativity. Now, you can read all about it within hours. You need not discover it again. Edison worked for years, at least for 3 years, to discover the first electric bulb. Now, you can go on producing electric bulbs. You don't need additions to produce them. Ordinary laborers, knowing nothing of electricity, can do the job. They are doing it. But religious truths are totally different. You have to discover it again and again. What Buddha discovered does not become universal property. It dies with him. It disappears with him. It is an individual flavor. That's the beauty of religion, that it never becomes a commodity in the marketplace. Hence, science can be taught in the schools, colleges, universities. Religion cannot be taught. Religion cannot be taught at all. You cannot be informed about religion. You have to discover it on your own. Yes, you can get the inspiration, but inspiration is not information. You can be inspired by the presence of a Buddha. You can become afire. You can attain to a burning longing to be like a Buddha. But you will have to discover everything on your own. And you will not be able to give it to your children as a heritage. All that can you give, all that you can impart is an intense longing for truth, that's all. But not truth itself. Hence it is very difficult for the masses to understand what I am saying. It was difficult when Buddha was here. It was difficult when Jesus was here. It will be difficult always, because masses live according to the past. They are fed up continuously, brought up in traditional ways. They have been told what is right, what is wrong. They have been told whether God exists or not. And they have learned all these things. And they had accumulated so much information that their minds are full of knowledge. They think they already know. So when anybody comes and brings a new dispensation into the world, when anybody brings a new revelation, when anybody becomes available to God, becomes a vehicle of God, the people are disturbed. Their prejudices are settled. Their old conceptions are not strengthened. On the contrary, they start feeling, if this man is right, then we have been wrong all along. Not only we, but our forefathers and their forefathers. This goes against their ego. They would rather cling to their own ego rather than listening to the truth. And then because of their prejudices, they go on hearing something which is not said. I say one thing, they immediately interpret it according to their own ideas. They don't listen in silence. They listen through all kinds of barriers of thoughts. For example, here are Jews, Mohammedans, Hindus, Christians, Jainas, Buddhists, Sikhs. All kinds of people are gathered here. Do you think when I say something, the Jew hears the same as the Jaina? The Mohammedan hears the same as the Christian? The Buddhist hears the same as the Hindu? Impossible. The Mohammedan has his own ideas. For example, if I am talking about rebirth, then the Christian, the Jew, and the Mohammedan are a little on guard, unconsciously, because they have been told there is only one life. They cannot trust that there are many lives. But when I am talking about rebirth, the Hindu is happy, absolutely willing. The Buddhist is willing, the Jaina is willing, absolutely willing. There is no problem in their minds. Not that they are agreeing with me. They are happy because I am agreeing with them. And that's how it is about each single statement. Words don't have any clear-cut meanings. They can't have. Otherwise, each communication will become very scientific. Words have many meanings, many nuances. So when you hear a word, you can give it a color of your own. You can hear in your own personal, private way. You have your own private meaning. When I talk about God, the Buddhist listening here will immediately stop listening. It is absolutely automatic. Automatically he will be turned off. God, He has been told that the whole idea is nonsense. And when Buddha has told that the whole idea is nonsense, it has to be so. And not only Buddha, for 25 centuries, many other mystics who have attained to the ultimate have been telling him that God is not there. But the Hindu, the Mohammedan, the Christian, the Jew, they are absolutely willing, immensely happy that yes, I am talking about God, their God. The Jaina and the Buddhist will not be happy. They don't believe in God. When I talk about the soul, the Jaina will be happy, the Hindu will be happy, the Mohammedan, the Christian, the Jew, everybody except the Buddhist. He does not believe in the soul either. He says there is no individual entity. Everything is a flux. Just as the Ganges goes on changing every moment, just as you cannot step in the same river twice, you cannot meet the same individual again. There is nothing permanent, nothing at all. Except change, everything changes. The Buddhist, the moment I talk about soul, our God, stops listening. He said, this is not for me. Not that he does it consciously. These are unconscious habits, conditionings. It is not so much that people are against me. The reality is they don't understand what I am talking about. Or they understand something totally different which is not being talked about. What I am doing here, they are not aware. They don't come here. They depend on newspapers. Some third-rate journalist comes and reports something. What he can report about meditation, he has never meditated. Look at the stupidity of the world. You don't send a journalist to report about a surgeon if he does not know anything about surgery, or do you? If there is going a conference of surgeons, you send somebody who is well acquainted with the world of surgery. Only he can report. If physicists are meeting, papers are read and discussed, you send somebody, you have to send an expert who knows what physics is. And modern physics is a very, very evolved phenomenon. It needs years of studies. One has to be a physicist. You can't depend on a general journalist who goes on reporting about mediocre politicians and their stupid speeches. You don't send the same type of journalist to report. When physicists are talking, you have to send a special person, or you have to appoint a physicist to report about the conference, because only he will be able to understand. It is said that when Albert Einstein was alive, only 12% really understood all over the world what he was talking about. Now who is going to report about him? Only one of these 12 may be able to report about Albert Einstein and his theory of relativity in such a way that at least some glimpse becomes possible to the common masses. But when you send a journalist here, you never inquire that he should be a meditator. that he should know something about meditation, something about yoga, something about Sufism, Zen, Tao, Tantra. No, these are not the requirements. Any Tom, Harry, Dick is thought to be perfectly capable of reporting about meditation, about Tantra, about Tao, about Zen, about Sufism. And people depend on his reports. And he has never meditated in his life. He has never had a single moment of meditation. He knows nothing of a state of no thought. He knows nothing of those intervals, those spaces where mind disappears, ego disappears, time disappears. How he can understand just by watching people sitting silently? Will you be able to understand anything if somebody is sitting silently with closed eyes? You can take a picture of the person. But you will not be able to take a picture of the inner happening. You can see people dancing. You can see them like Sufis, whirling dervishes. You can see them dancing. And you will report about that you saw people dancing, jumping. But how you are going to know their inner world? You should participate. You should dance yourself. You should have a taste of it. Only then you may be able to report something of it. Only something, not all of it. Because all of it is impossible to report. All of it is inexpressible. And when these people report, who don't understand, their report is only sensational. And then masses read them, and they read even that report according to their own ideas. Then misunderstanding upon misunderstanding. Layers and layers of misunderstanding. I must be the most misunderstood man in this country at this moment. Caroline, a curvaceous traveling sales lady, was waiting her turn to register at a motel when she overheard the desk clerk tell Zebrowski, the man in front of her, that he had just gotten the last room. She waited for the Pole to leave the desk and then approached him. "There is not another motel within miles and I am dead tired," she pleaded. "Look, you don't know me. I don't know you. They don't know us. We don't know them. How is about me spending the night with you?" "I don't care," said Zebrowski. They went to his room. He took off his clothes and so did she. "Listen," she said, "you don't know me. I don't know you. They don't know us. We don't know them. Let us have a few drinks. I got a bottle." After they had gotten a little high, she cuddled up to him and whispered, "You don't know me. I don't know you. They don't know us. We don't know them. Let us have a party." "Hey," said the Pole, "if I don't know you, and you don't know me, and they don't know us, and we don't know them, who the hell we gonna invite? Now the word party is creating the trouble. The Pole is going to understand according to his idea of a party. Carolyn has something else in her mind. A real party. What I am saying is totally different from what is being understood by the outsiders. But that is natural and I accept it. I have no grudge, no complaint about it. It's how it is going to be. I can be understood only by those who are in deep love, who are in deep trust with me. I can be understood only by those who are ready to put their minds aside. In that state of silence, something from me can stir your heart, can trigger a process of understanding. The fourth question. Bhagwan, where do rebellion and surrender meet? Prem Rajo, rebellion and surrender meet in the idea of the ego. Drop the ego. And simultaneously, surrender happens and rebellion too. I know what do you mean by your question. You mean that rebellion and surrender seem to be polar opposites. How can they meet? How can one be rebellious and surrender? That's your question. That's how mind thinks about rebellion and surrender. Through the mind, you cannot see them meeting anywhere. A man who is surrendered will look non-rebellious. A man who is rebellious will always be disobeying. How can he surrender? He may die, but he will not surrender. You know only one kind of surrender, the surrender that is forced on you, the surrender that is not done by you, but you are made to do it. At the point of a dagger, you are forced to surrender. That is not surrender I am talking about. I am talking of a totally different kind of surrender. You are not forced. You see the ugliness of the ego. You see the misery of the ego. You see the stinking ego and you use the master as an excuse to drop the ego. The master is always an excuse, remember. When you surrender to me, you are not surrendering to anybody in particular, because I am not there as a person. And when you surrender, I am not accepting your surrender, remember. Because there is nothing to surrender, just a false idea of the ego. It is like a man who believes that he is rich and he is not. And he comes to me and he says, I surrender my whole kingdom to you. I say, okay, I accept. I accept so that you can get rid of it, this nonsense. You don't have it, so it is not going to create any trouble for me. Two hippies were resting under a tree. Full moon night. And they were really high. One looked long at the moon and then said, I would like to purchase it. And I am ready to give any price. The other said, forget all about it, because I'm not going to sell it. When you surrender your ego, you are not surrendering anything which is real, just an idea. If it was really something, then the master will be burdened by so many egos, will be killed. He will have to carry a Himalaya of egos. It will be impossible to live for him, even to walk, even to breathe. I have 100,000 sannyasins in the world. Now 100,000 egos if I have to keep, then Vivek will go mad. She goes mad about other things. She has to arrange so many presents come to me, and she wants to dispose them immediately, because it becomes a burden on her to go on collecting them and to keep track where they are and to keep them clean. Now she is very much worried about my fountain pens. She goes on asking every day, when you are going to distribute these? Because it is becoming a problem for her. I think I must be having 200 or more. And I am waiting so that at least I can give one fountain pen to each sannyasin. I am waiting. Now it will be a problem for me whom to give and whom not to give. So I go and telling him, wait a little, wait. And I am telling many people, go on bringing. Now Niranjana is going especially to the west to bring as many fountain pens as possible. But if I have to keep all these egos, it will be impossible. Laos house is too small. I accept your ego happily, because there is no problem in accepting it. You are not giving anything to me. I am not taking anything from you. But you are getting rid of an idea, a fantasy. And your getting rid of it is the point. It is not surrender forced on you. It is surrender out of your own understanding. And then rebellion happens on its own accord. Because a man without the ego is the most rebellious in the world. Again remember, when I use the word rebellion, I don't mean it in the political sense. A man without the ego cannot have any politics. Politics needs great egoists. The whole game of politics is the game of ego. It is ego trip. When you are no more burdened by the ego, when you have been unburdened, when the master has taken your so-called ego away from you, your life will be that of a rebel, of tremendous revolution. You will not be a Hindu, and you will not be a Mohammedan, and you will not be a Christian, and you will not be a Jaina. This is revolution. You will not be a German, and you will not be a Japanese, and you will not be an Indian. This is revolution. You will not belong to any religion, to any sect, to any society, to any tradition. This is revolution. And because there is no ego, God can flow through you. Great creativity becomes possible. This is revolution. And you will live now in a total let go. In fact, God will live through you, not you. And God cannot be a slave. And God cannot be reduced to any slavery. And you cannot be reduced to any slavery either now. Prem Rajo, rebellion and surrender certainly meet in dropping the ego. But don't just go on trying to understand these things theoretically. Do something existential. So what I am saying becomes your experience. Because only experience liberates. The fourth question. Bhagwan, I hear the Indians bragging too much about their spirituality. What do you say about it? Sahajo, Indians have nothing else to brag about. Forgive them. Be compassionate over them. They don't have money. They don't have big houses. They don't have big cars. They don't have anything of science, technology. It is very difficult for them to maintain their ego. Spirituality is their shelter. And spirituality is a commodity. You can brag about it very easily because nobody can prove that you don't have it. Neither you can prove that you have it. It is so invisible that either you accept it or you don't accept it, but you cannot prove it. And why particularly spirituality? It sometimes happens that if you are very greedy, you will pretend just the opposite, because that is the only way to hide the greed. If you are a very angry person, you may pretend to be very polite, compassionate, loving, because that is the only way to hide your anger. If you are obsessed with sex, you may start talking about brahmacharya, celibacy. The opposite is the way to hide it. Indian mind is utterly materialistic. And the only way to hide it is to talk about, brag about spirituality. Yes, there have been few people in this country, a Buddha, a Mahavira, a Patanjali, a Krishna, who were utterly spiritual. But such people have been everywhere. Heraclitus, Pythagoras, Socrates, Plotinus in Greece. The same type of people, the same quality, the same fragrance. Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Li Tzu, Mencius in China, the same perfume. Christ, Eckhart, Francis, Bohme, the same dimension. Spiritual people have been everywhere. It is nobody's possession. But Indians brag about it, I know. Sahajo, I can understand your question. Because what you see all around is just the opposite. That's why they brag about spirituality. Each Indian thinks that just by being an Indian, he is a Buddha. It is not so easy to be a Buddha. And Buddha has nothing to do by being an Indian. In fact, Buddha was not an Indian. He was a Nepalese. He was born on the border of India and Nepal. In fact, now that part is in Nepal. And the statue of Buddha that you see does not look like a Nepalese, or it looks. It is not a true statue. It does not look like Bahadur. Nepalese are closer to the Chinese, Tibetans, Japanese, the Mongol type. Buddha's statue does not look like a Nepalese, not at all. The statues were not made at the time of Buddha. When he died, after 500 years, the statues were being made. And you will be surprised to know they were made in imitation of Alexander the Great. Alexander had come to India by that time. And he had a beautiful face, the Greek features. The statue of the Buddha is Greek, The man himself was Nepalese. The statue is Greek. And all the scriptures that you read about Buddha are not original. Some are being translated from Tibetan, some from Chinese, some from Japanese. The originals were destroyed by the Hindus. And now the same Hindus go on proclaiming that they are the inheritors of Buddha. Buddhists were killed by the Indians. A time came after Buddha's death, after 700-800 years, that all the Buddhists either were killed or they had to escape out of India. The India was completely cleaned of the Buddhists. Yes, they were killed, burnt alive. Those who were fortunate, they escaped. In a way, that was a blessing. Because the people who escaped, the monks, they escaped to Tibet, to China. Those who were not too much afraid, they escaped to Tibet. Tibet was very close. Those who were very much afraid, they went to China, to Mongolia, to Korea, to Taiwan. They simply never stopped. They went on and on. That's how the whole Asia was converted to Buddhism. The whole credit goes to the Hindus. And now these same Hindus go on claiming that Buddha, we have given birth to Buddha. Feel ashamed. But India is poor. Very materialistic it is. Poor people cannot be otherwise. A poor person is bound to be materialistic. Grossly materialistic. But then where? To feed one's ego. India has nothing else to brag about. Spirituality is a good commodity, invisible, unprovable. Anybody can say, I have experienced God. You cannot disprove. Maybe he is right. Maybe he is not right. But it is beyond proof. This way or that. But don't be worried about these stupid people who go on talking about spirituality, not knowing even the ABC of it. Yes, they may know something about the Vedas and the Upanishads. They may have crammed few sutras. They may repeat parrot-like. But they don't understand what they are saying. Because their life belies it. Excuse me, sir, said the Indian, but are not you the gentleman that fetched my son out of the lake yesterday? Why, yes, I am, said the embarrassed rescuer. But that's all right. Let's just say nothing more about it. Say nothing about it, shrieked the Indian. Indeed, man, where is his cap? He is not even grateful. He has not come to say thanks to the person that you have saved the life of my child. He is worried about the cap. A Mexican, an Italian, and an Indian were discussing what they would do if they awoke one morning to discover that they were millionaires. The Mexican said he would build a bull ring. The Italian said he would hire 30 hookers, one for each night of the month. The Indian said he would go to sleep again and see if he could make another million. If you watch the Indian mind, it is materialistic. And it is not that it is materialistic only today. It has always been. Because 25 centuries before, Buddha was telling people not to be materialists. And he was talking to the Indians. And even before Buddha, almost 25 centuries before Buddha, Parsunatha was telling Indians not to be materialists. India has given the greatest materialist philosophy to the world, the philosophy of the Charvakas. The Greek philosopher Epicurus is nothing compared to the philosophy that Charvakas have given to the world. The word Charvaka is significant. It comes from Charuvak. Charuvak means sweet message, beautiful message. Another name of the philosophy of the Charvakas is Lokayat. Lokayat means popular. In which the majority of the people believe. Maybe it is because of the Indian materialism that a Buddha, a Mahavira, a Parsunatha, a Neminatha were possible. When people are too much materialistic, few intelligent people are bound to get bored by the whole thing. It becomes nauseating. It becomes sickening. Life works in a very strange way. When the society is materialistic, few avant-garde people start becoming spiritualists. Now the West is very materialist, and a great longing for spirituality is arising there. That's why you have come here. You don't see many Indians here. They believe they already know. They believe they have nothing to do anymore, research. Any more inquiry. And they have become very cunning. Poor people become cunning. Poor people are bound to become cunning. Poverty is the root cause of all sins, of all crimes. So they start learning devious ways they start becoming hypocrites. They say one thing, they do another thing. They start learning how to wear masks. You can see it not only in the ordinary people, but the so-called leaders and saints, political and religious. You will not find such hypocrites anywhere else. An airplane crossing the Atlantic ran into engine trouble. After dumping all the baggage to lighten the load, the pilot informed the passengers that three people would have to jump in order to save the rest. "We need three volunteers," announced the pilot. Immediately, an Englishman left his seat, shouted, "God save the Queen," and jumped out. And in a little while, a Frenchman got up and said, "Long live France," and took the plunge. 5 minutes later, an Indian politician in pure snow white hand-spun clothes stood up, screamed, "Long live Mahatma Gandhi," and threw a Mexican out the door. The sixth question: Bhagwan, with the threat of nuclear destruction, how can we be joyful and serene? Julia Bradley, what else you can do? Time is short. Dance, sing, be joyous. If there was no nuclear destruction possible, no threat, you could have postponed. You could have said, "Tomorrow we will dance." But now there may be tomorrow, no tomorrow. You cannot postpone. This is for the first time that tomorrow is absolutely doubtful. It has always been doubtful, but this time it is absolutely doubtful. Individually, it is always doubtful. Tomorrow may never come. Even the next breath may not come in. Individually, death is always imminent. But this time, it is something global, universal. The whole earth may disappear, may explode. Not only all human beings, birds, animals, trees, the whole life may be gone. Now it is up to you, Julia Bradley. You can cry and weep, and you can beat your head against the wall. That will not stop nuclear destruction and its threat. In fact, it may bring it closer and faster. Because sad people, miserable people, are dangerous people. Misery creates destructiveness. But if the whole humanity can start dancing, rejoicing, feasting, seeing that the threat is very close by. The Third World War can start any moment. The foolish politicians have enough atomic energy piled up to destroy this earth. Not only once, but 700 times. That much atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, have become accumulated. That we can kill each person 700 times. Although a person dies only once, but politicians don't want to take any chance. So 700 times you can be killed. It will not be needed. One time will do. Because we have heard only one story of resurrection, that is Jesus Christ. And even if Jesus Christ is resurrected and everybody is gone, what he is going to do? He will have to commit suicide. Rejoice. Because then there is a possibility, if the whole earth can become full of joy, it will be less possible to destroy. Because who is going to destroy? We are the people. It is up to us to decide that we want to live or we want to commit suicide. If we start a new climate in the world of rejoicing, of dancing, of singing, of meditation, of prayer, and if people become full of bliss, cheerfulness, laughter, if the world is full of laughter, there is every possibility we can avoid the nuclear destruction. Because joyous people don't want to destroy. They want to create. And anyway, Julia Bradley, you are going to die. Whether the whole earth remains or not does not matter. You are going to die. That much is certain. How does it matter to you whether after you the world continues or not? If it continues, good. If it does not continue, good. How does it matter to you? You will not be here anymore. And as far as you are concerned, death is absolutely certain. Still you love. Still you sing, you listen to music. So what difference does it make? If destruction has become global, we have to make laughter and dancing also global in the same proportion to counteract it. Why be sad? And what you are going to gain by sadness, is it going to help in any way? It may be just a trick of the mind to keep you sad. It may be just a defense. You must be sad. Now you are trying to find more and more rationalizations for remaining sad. And this is a beautiful rationalization. That what are you talking, Bhagwan? Telling people to dance and sing and rejoice, and the world is on the verge of destruction? Tell people to be sad. Tell people to cry and weep and forget all laughter and forget all love. Is that going to help in any way? It will bring the universal society closer. But somewhere deep down in you there is a sadness that does not want to leave you. And that sadness is trying to find rationalizations. David came from an orthodox family. One day he announced, "Mama, I am going to marry an Irish girl named Maggie Coyle." The woman froze in shock. "That's nice, David," she said, "but don't tell your papa. You know, he has got a weak heart. And I would not tell your sister, Ida. Remember how strongly she feels about religious questions. And don't mention it to your brother Louis. He might give you a bus in the mouth. Me, it is all right, you told. I'm gonna commit suicide anyway." You must have somewhere deep down a suicidal instinct. You are just finding rationalizations. Yes, I know. The world is facing a danger. But each individual has always faced the danger of death. Still, Jesus says, "Rejoice and rejoice. And I say to you again, rejoice." And in fact, Jesus was saying to people that this world is to be destroyed soon. The day of judgment is very close by. It was never so close as it is now. Jesus was wrong. 20 centuries have passed. And he was saying to people that in your very life you will see the day of judgment. His prophecy was not fulfilled. In fact, he was not a prophet. He was a mystic. He was saying these things for a totally different purpose. He was saying the day of judgment is very close by. Transform yourself. Don't waste time. Don't postpone. Now, the day of universal death is really close by. So, Julia, don't postpone. Rejoice. Rejoice. I say unto you, rejoice again and again. Because if you can die rejoicing, you will transcend death. You will go beyond death. One who can die blissfully never dies. Because in death he comes to know immortality. And if the time is short, then you have to spread this orange laughter all over the world. Then it is time that we should make people more and more joyous. Tell them the death can take over this earth any moment. The days are counted, because the politicians are fools, and the fools have so much power now that it is a sheer miracle how it has not happened yet, the Third World War. It should have happened. Why it has not happened yet is a mystery. Having all these stupid politicians all over the world, having all the power, just pushing a button and the process can be triggered, and within 10 minutes' time the whole earth will be on fire. A fire that can melt steel and rocks. A fire that will melt everything. The whole earth can explode. This is good news. You don't have time to waste. Julia, come on, join the dance. Enough for today.